My second anecdote involves a talk I once heard on Jewish law at a convention of the annual convention of the American Association of Law Schools. And for those of you who might be interested in legal education, you should all be aware that Jewish law has now become an academically respectable subject in American law schools. There is actually a section on Jewish law as part of the American Association, the AALS. There is our professorships of Jewish law at Ivy League schools such as Harvard and Columbia, NYU, University of Pennsylvania. Courses in Jewish law are offered in a number of other law schools as well. I myself offered a 17-week seminar in the University of Maryland on reproductive technologies and Jewish law. So it is an academically respectable field. And I went to hear two presentations on the teaching of Jewish law in American law schools. The first was by a Jewish man who was also an ordained rabbi as well as a law professor, a very, very esteemed scholar. And the thrust of his overall presentation was that Jewish law is as good as any other secular course. Contracts has case law, Jewish law has case law. Contracts has analytic structure, Jewish law has analytic structure, etc. The same social policy issues that every secular law subject deals with, Jewish law deals with. And the tenor of the presentation was, you can do X and we can do better, etc. Whatever you have in those other subjects, we have as well. And all of that is very true, as I will be showing myself. But then another fellow got up who was a Mormon who taught at Brigham Young University. So he was not Jewish, and I can assure you that probably none of his students were Jewish as well. But for some reason, he was very interested in teaching Jewish law, and he teaches and writes on Jewish law. And he got up and said, wait a second, he said to the first guy, wait a second. By making Jewish law the same as every secular law system, you're missing one very important point. And that is the idea of holiness, the idea of sanctity, the idea that Jewish law is not supposed to simply be like any other secular system, but it has a role in molding character and spirituality. There's almost a reversal here. I would have expected the non-Jewish scholar to emphasize the legalistic aspects of the system, and the Jewish scholar to emphasize the spiritual and transcendental aspects of the system. But here it is exactly the opposite, where the Jewish person emphasized its pure legal facets, and the non-Jewish Mormon emphasized its transcendental spiritual aspects. And the Mormon gave a story how the teaching of Jewish law impacted on his own life. He had been studying one of the laws in Deuteronomy that basically says that if somebody owes you money, you are not allowed to engage in harassment in the attempt to collect the debt. This is kind of an early debtor protection law that obviously if someone owes you money, you're allowed to collect it, but if they don't have the money to pay you, you don't humiliate them, you don't harass them, you don't threaten them if they're unable to come up with the money. In fact, the Talmud tells us that in order to spare debtors potential embarrassment, the rabbis who were owed money would literally not even walk by the homes of the debtors in the street, lest the debtor or the debtor's family see them and become ashamed, humiliated, or embarrassed. Well, this professor said, somebody had owed me $500 and I was getting pretty irritated because he hadn't paid me the money yet. But after studying this passage, I realized that there was a message for how I must live my life in my own personal realm. And instead of calling him up for the money, I sent him a turkey for the holidays. The example of a life of holiness, that there is a transcendental spiritual aspect to Jewish law that can never be forgotten. And this brings me really to a final preliminary point, and then I'll get into some of the sources of Jewish law. And that is, Jewish law, I think, is unusual because there is the use of a legal system to achieve goals of spiritual perfection. If one studies Paul and the apostles and his critique of Judaism, we actually find that Judaism is often criticized for being too legalistic, that Judaism has a maze of rules and obligations and rituals and even interpersonal requirements. We have a whole book, for example, on the laws of gossip. What are you allowed to say, what you're not allowed to say? And many have said, gee, isn't it more important just to have general directives, be a good person, be a generous person, be a kind person, and then leave it to the specific individual to make those decisions? Why is Judaism so obsessed with legal minutiae? And doesn't that distract from the overall spiritual message that Judaism is supposed to communicate? And you'll often find fundamentalist Christians, for example, may criticize the Jewish system for its over-preoccupation with the law. That indeed was one of the critiques of Paul in the Apostles, that Judaism or the Jewish tradition had taken law instead of faith as its predicate. But in defense of the Jewish tradition, again, without casting aspersions in any other tradition, let me say that God in his infinite wisdom realizes that human beings have an infinite capacity for delusion and self-rationalization. If you simply tell human beings, be good, and then leave it to them to figure out what is good and what is moral, then people are very likely to confuse doing well with doing good. People are very likely to confuse the expedient and the easy with what is the moral and the eternal. And therefore, God kind of says, I'm not going to trust human beings to simply devise their own ethical and moral systems. But I will communicate to them the foundations of that system through revealed truth in the scripture, in the Bible, in the Talmud, and we will discuss the other sources of Jewish law as well. So on one hand, the halakhic system is predicated on a realistic mistrust based on the capacity of human beings to fool themselves. And consequently, we are given structure. We don't simply say, be a nice guy, but we say, don't revenge, don't bear grudges. We have rules regarding gossip. What can you say? What can't you say? When can I tell somebody, don't go to that person because he does a bad job? And when do I have to keep my mouth shut? We are given regulation. So consequently, the goal is not to become obsessed with minutiae at the expense of a spiritual vision, but to realize that we need guidance and discipline in order to achieve those transcendental spiritual values. At the same time, while the halakhic structure reflects a mistrust in the ability of humans to escape self-delusion and rationalization, it is also profoundly optimistic because it recognizes that by adherence to these values, moral perfection can be achieved. Once again, going back to Paul, Paul's argument in the New Testament was that the ability of a human being to live by the law is so impossible that there is no way a human being could ever achieve salvation through law or works, but only through faith. The burden was too much to bear. It was impossible for a person to escape the taint of sinfulness and mistake. But Judaism, I think, is more optimistic in the sense that Judaism essentially says adherence to the law is possible, it is accessible, it is desirable, it is obtainable. And consequently, side by side with a mistrust in the human capacity to make up our own rules, there is a profound optimism that by living by this divine law of God, one can achieve individually and societally a state of perfection. Now granted, because we are weak, that state of ultimate perfection is not likely to be achieved. But once again, as I quoted earlier in Pirkei Avot, even if we can't finish the job, we do as much as we can and we achieve that connection to God to whatever degree that we're able to do so. And thus we have the unusual use of law as a tool for moral and spiritual perfection rather than simply creating the conditions of a stable society. That, of course, is another outgrowth, but there is that element of moral and spiritual perfection as well. Let me also mention that those of you who are familiar with the more controversial elements in legal education know that there's a movement, it's a little bit on the wane today, but during the 80s and 90s it reached its heyday, and that was critical legal studies. And one of the branches of critical legal studies involved an offshoot that was called feminist jurisprudence, in which many legal scholars, mainly women, but there were some men as well, took the position that Anglo-American law, really all of the Western law tradition, was profoundly masculine in its orientation, and therefore could not be fully understood unless one exposed the masculine or the sexist tendencies within the system. Well, I would like to say, and this is based on some work of a colleague of mine, Stephen Friedel, that paradoxically, Jewish law could be described as a system that shares many of the common arguments advanced by feminist jurisprudence. The primary argument that feminist jurisprudence made, that Anglo-American law is masculine, is not so much because of the discriminations between men and women, that's a separate matter, but rather simply because there is a fundamental difference, it is posited, between the way men, as a general matter, view their essential identity and the way women view their essential identity. This goes back to some pioneering work that Carol Gilligan did in the 1980s in her famous work, A Different Voice, in which she pointed out that young children, even as young as 6, 7, or 8, responded very differently to certain moral dilemmas, whether they were men or whether they were boys or whether they were girls. The hypothetical she asked was, imagine that you had a child who needed some medicine or he might die, and the only drugstore that has the medicine is closed for the evening, and if you wait until the morning, your child might die, what do you do? Every little boy that was asked the question basically said, you take a rock, you break the window, and you take the medicine, because saving a life is more important than stealing. Now, on one level, that's a perfectly legitimate answer, because indeed, saving a life has priority. But the girls that were asked the same question conceded that saving a life was important. But the achievement of one goal cannot be at the expense of other goals. So the girls, even at a young age, said, be sure to leave a note. Let's call the police before we break the window. The concept was, with boys, it was on-off, yes-no, one thing or the other thing. With girls, they viewed the world as a tapestry of complicated relationships. Dr. Gilligan's phrase was, with boys, it was a ladder, and with girls, it was a web. And even focusing on one goal cannot be at the expense of another goal. And the thesis that was propounded is that men regard their fundamental sense of identity as themselves, autonomy, control, separateness. And women view the world in terms of integration and relationship. In fact, this is really responsible for the famous truism why men don't like to stop and ask directions, simply because asking somebody for directions is surrendering control and autonomy. With women, we sometimes see the opposite. They want to ask directions as soon as they leave the driveway, because reaching out to others is not a threat, but it's part of one's essential sense of self. Based on this, I think the feminist jurisprudence people came up with a really interesting insight. I think it's a valid insight, that the legal model of Anglo-American jurisprudence posits human beings as isolated individuals who live in their own sphere, who have the right to be left alone until they bump into the sphere of another. Meaning, I can do what I want. Again, John Stuart Mill's classic definition, I should be allowed to do what I want. I should be allowed to swing my fist until it enters the area of your nose. Now, this is predicated on a model of the human being as essentially an atom, an isolated atom or electron, swimming in space, where the only demands a legal society makes are the demands of not interfering with somebody else's isolated orbit. And that is why, under Anglo-American law, there is no duty of rescue. If I'm walking by and a child has fallen into the water, and I can very easily save their lives. And I simply don't want to do it because I'm late for an appointment. I incur no liability at all. As long as I didn't push him in, as long as my negligence didn't cause his fall, there is no affirmative duty to help others that needs your assistance. And this is based on a masculine view of law, that each person has their own life. Each person has no responsibility for anybody else unless they interfere with someone else's autonomy. The feminist view of the world would be very different, and the feminist view would indeed say we live in a world of mutual responsibility and shared commitments. In that sense, although Jewish law does have significant discriminations between men and women, but I think Jewish law very much has this feminist view of the world in which we are indeed responsible for each other. Leviticus chapter 19 basically says very explicitly, Lo tamod al dam reyecha, if I see somebody in physical, mental, spiritual, psychological danger or peril, it is not enough for me not to hurt. I have an affirmative obligation to do whatever I can to help another human being. The legal demand of thou shalt not hurt gets transmuted into a much more fundamental demand. You must render assistance to all that you're able to help. So in this paradoxical way, although I would not describe Jewish law as necessarily pro-women in its particularized rules, but it does adopt that view of reality that Dr. Carol Gilligan entitled the web rather than the ladder. Instead of just saying one or the other, Jewish law recognizes the complex existence of interlocking relationships and mutual dependency. In fact, we find, for example, that even in formal litigation in front of a Jewish rabbinic court, we often encourage mediation and compromise rather than strict legal adjudication, because mediation and compromise facilitates shalom, harmony, friendship, interpersonal peace. And that is said to be a better preferable outcome than simply winner take all, where one person is the winner and one person is the loser. The commentaries tell us that this is exactly why for the Beit HaMikdash, the annual contribution in the temple, one gave half a shekel as opposed to a whole shekel, because a half is incomplete except when it unites with another half and it becomes whole. That notion that we need each other and we have to have a world of interdependence and cooperation, a notion of communitarian obligations of charity and benevolence and the like. So these are some preliminary reflections on the nature of Jewish law and some of the values that it espouses, the values of holiness, the values of love, the values of compassion, the values of adherence to the law of God, and the value of an obligation ethic based on communitarian sharing rather than one that is simply based on rights and self-vindication and autonomy.